Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. Balancing a career as a White House reporter with the responsibility of raising two daughters sounds nearly impossible, but journalist April Ryan, Washington Bureau Chief for American Urban Radio Networks, does it in stride. In At Mama's Knee, Mothers and Race in Black and White, Ms. Ryan writes about race and intolerance through the lessons that she has taught her children as a single African-American mother in Baltimore. The book is published by Rowan and Littlefield, and I'm pleased that it has brought April Ryan to the show. How are you, April?
I'm fine, Jonathan. How are you?
Good. Congratulations on your new book. This is the second one, or the third
one? Yes, this is the second one.
So let's start at the beginning, because, yes. I mean, as I said in your intro, you are the Washington Bureau Chief. How'd you end up becoming the Washington Bureau Chief and covering the White House?
I fell into it, actually. What does the Bible say? Be ye ready. I was working in Baltimore and in Washington, and what happened was I was also doing a lot of stringing or freelancing work for the network, and they liked what I was offering. And they said, you know, we had a job opening. And they told me it was for D.C. Bureau Chief. I said, oh, okay. And then little did I know it was for the White House. And back then I was young and really thinking I could do anything I wanted, and I took the job. and looking back, I'm like, what were you thinking? But I've been here, you know, it's 20 years later, so it must have worked.
But what do you mean you took the job, you got there, and you realize, now you wonder, what were you thinking? This has been a good ride. How many presidents have you covered already?
January 20th at 12:01, it will be four presidents. When you're young, you think you're invincible and you can move mountains. Oh, yeah, I can do this. Not looking at really what could be in my face or coming down the road. And I said, oh, I can do this. Not having the kind of experience that many of the seasoned journalists, the veterans here, had. And I jumped into Washington straight from pretty much local radio being Baltimore, mm-hmm. and local radio, you know, doing some evening and weekend work at WTOP in Washington, D.C., one of the most successful news stations in the nation. And I jumped in with feet first. I mean, just immersed myself. And I mean, I almost drowned, but I'm still treading water.
but that's the way you do it, especially in Washington. You have to jump in feet first.
Oh,
but April, I mean, again, you're African-American. Mm-hmm. That pool of African-American reporters, particularly covering the White House, is not terribly deep.
It's not. This is a white male-dominated town, white male-dominated industry. And Ken Strickland, who is the head of the D.C. Bureau, he's the Washington Bureau Chief for NBC, he was very poignant with a statement that he said. He said something to the effect that many African Americans do not get into political journalism. And the numbers are not there like we would think they would be. And yes, the pool is very small, and I am one of them at the premier place,
mm-hmm.
the White House, the place where everything comes to the White House, from water piece and anything in between.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the pool, and I'm not going to belabor your White House experience here, but being in the pool means you sit in the White House press briefing room in your assigned seat, and the press secretary comes out, or at least for the next however many days President Obama is the president, and we don't know yet what President-elect Trump is going to do with his press operation, but you sit in those seats and you're all throwing up your hands trying to get the press secretary to call on you to ask a question. Do you know for a fact that sometimes they might avoid picking on you to ask a question?
when they know certain things, maybe so, when they know certain things that I may be thinking about asking and they want to not deal with it, you'll see them go around the room and go around the room. It's like, okay, I'll get to her. You know, they try to soften the blow of what I could be asking. So, but yes, there are days that they want to make sure that they call on me, I'm sure, when there are issues that they want to talk about, and other days it might make them cringe to even see my hand go up. But mm-hmm. it's all good. Mm-hmm. It's part of the dance that we do every day.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, in today for Leonard Lopate, and speaking with April Ryan. She is the Washington Bureau Chief for American Urban Radio Networks, and she is the author of the new book, At Mama's Knee, Mothers and Race in Black and White. And taking you back into the White House press briefing room, you were there that day. I was there that day as sort of a special guest in that I don't go to White House press briefing room often. But on the day that President Obama walked into the room to address the nation, really, in the aftermath of the verdict, the not guilty verdict, the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the killing of Trayvon Martin. And it was one of the most poignant moments in the Obama presidency, with the president of the United States speaking personally and emphatically about race before the nation. You were there. What did you think? That was a surprise for him, for you all, when he walked into the room.
I felt something in the nation. And you have to remember, that weekend I had to speak. The NAACP convention was in Orlando, Florida. And I was there that night. I was landing as the I landed in the airport. I landed at the airport, and then I was walking through the terminal and watched the screens just miles away with the verdict for George Zimmerman. And I felt a certain tension in the airport, and that tension reverberated throughout the nation. And then that night, I was watching people walk through the hotel room at the NAACP convention, and they were talking about that Sunday morning, they had changed the schedule because they had to meet about what was happening. And I felt it there. I was listening throughout the nation. I was getting tweets, emails, messages on Facebook, and I felt it coming in. I mean, there are moments that you can actually feel. You can feel, mm-hmm. taste, and smell, and that was one of those. And when I came back to the White House that next Monday, that just a couple days away from that verdict that Saturday night, we felt it. We knew something had to happen because mm-hmm. the nation was still talking about it. This was a vigilante who killed an African-American boy who actually shot him to death because he was wearing a hoodie. He profiled him. And
we should say Trayvon Martin was unarmed and 17 years old.
Unarmed. And he had, what is it, candy in his pocket?
Skittles and an iced
Skittles,
tea.
Skittles, yes, yeah. And President Obama came out and spoke on that because he had actually, after Trayvon Martin was killed, you know, he said that could have been me. And if you remember the Trayvon Martin story, the reason why it came up, it was a slow news day and CBS found it.
Mm-hmm.
And no one was really talking about it. But what made it so impactful was that it was this local watch guy, this neighborhood watch guy who was in a gated community mm-hmm. in Florida. And that's what perked the ears. And then it started rolling. The ball started rolling. Go ahead.
Well, you know, April, also what made the story so resonant once mm-hmm. it did become a national story was how it sparked the conversation, took yeah. the conversation about the talk from yeah. within and among within the African-American community and among African-Americans mm-hmm. to the wider, broader public. And I remember writing a piece talking about the talk and the rules that my mother taught me, such as don't run in public, you know, don't run with your hands in your pockets, things like run carrying something, things like that. And the number of people I heard from saying, particularly white colleagues and white friends saying, one, I've never had that talk. My parents never had that talk with me, or saying they have teenage kids and they've never had that talk with their children. Talk about, and this is the whole reason of your book, The Talk. Why is it so important for people to understand, all people to understand the importance of this talk?
And it's so interesting you say that, that your mother, and I start out in the book talking about how it's a rite of passage, really. It's a life and death issue for our young black boys to get the talk from the dad. But now that more women are, particularly minority women, are increasing as the head of household and in the sole breadwinner, we are the ones giving our children. It's interesting that you say that, that your mother did that, mm-hmm. you know, for you as a child. And that's what I talk about here. And I start out the first few pages with Sabrina Fulton talking about that. About how she gave the talk to her two sons,
Trayvon,
yes, mm-hmm. and Javaris, about the talk and how to move forward and live life, to live. This is a survival skill. And she said, you know, she told her children no one is better than anyone, and she put them in a multicultural school so that they could know more about, you know, all races, and but she still gave them the talk.
Mm-hmm.
And she was living in the Florida area, so she started it off. And thinking about what you said, you know, about your talk, Valerie Jarrett, senior advisor to President Obama and the best friend of the president and the first lady, she said, you know, after all of this, many of her friends, colleagues that she's worked with, white people, said they'd never heard about the talk. So the talk is intrinsic in the black community and even in the Latino community.
I was about to ask, this is a talk that goes on in communities of color or non-majority communities, as you said before, as a survival skill.
Right, as a survival skill. And what was so interesting after Trayvon and after all of the crescendo moment after the death, before the trial but after the death, and how President Obama said he could have been me. You know, that work, he could have been my son. You know, and people were like, what? It was obvious. And I'm like, what part did you not understand? You know, I'm still flabbergasted by it. But the bottom line is it put a spotlight on the ills of the black community from the highest office in the land. And President Obama talked, he didn't have his dad to give him the talk. You know, but he talked about how his mother, in my book, helped him understand who he was as a black person and as a black man. She would read to him and send him information about the civil rights marches and civil rights issues to help him be fully aware of who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not necessarily embracing the issue of the talk per se, this is how you have to carry yourself, but she made him aware of the perils and also the successes of the people that he would be embraced by and the community that he is a part of.
Yeah, we're going to have to go to a break in a little bit, but I have to ask you this. You also say that the talk could be a catch-22 for single black mothers. Why is that?
You know, because the sad piece about it is that we're by ourselves. And, men should be in the home a lot of times, and they should be there to help give the talk. It's sad in a lot of ways that we have to be the ones to give it. Society is structured. But, I mean, it's not sad, but it is sad.
Mm-hmm.
Society is structured where, you know, women are now the head of the household, and then the man a lot of times is not around. But, you know, for a young man to understand the perils from a dad is the greatest thing, to hear from their dad. But, unfortunately, we are the ones who have to – it's a great thing that we are giving nurturing lessons of life to our children. But we would also like that other piece, too.
Well, I mean, come on, April. I mean, moms play a huge role. Whether dad is in the picture,
I'm doing it by myself
or not,
all the way around, and commuting back and forth from Baltimore to D.C.
And we're going
to 2-hour commute each way.
Well, we're going to have the traffic report after. No, I'm kidding, April. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come right back. I'm speaking to the journalist April Ryan about how mothers struggle to explain race relations to their young children. Her latest book is At Mama's Knee: Mothers and Race in Black and White. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and today for Leonard Lopate, speaking with White House correspondent, Washington Bureau Chief for American Urban Radio Network's April Ryan. And April is the author of her second book called At Mama's Knee, Mothers and Race In Black and White. April, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So we were talking about the talk and the talk to African-American boys and how that should be done, you know, from your perspective by father
and young girls.
Yes, and that gets to the question I'm going to ask you, April. Have you had the conversation, the talk, with your two daughters, Ryan and Grace? And before, is your daughter's name really Ryan?
No. People think that. No, her. I kept my maiden name, and she has her first name is my maiden name, and her last name is James. Ryan
okay.
Is James.
All right.
No,
so have
not
you?
Ryan. Oh my
goodness. So have you had the talk with Ryan and Grace?
Yes, I have, and on a number of occasions. And Jonathan, as you know, being in this business is all consuming. And they see the things on TV. You know, when I'm up in the morning fixing breakfast, I'm like, Mommy, Gracie will say, Mommy, did that really happen? I'm like, yes, sweetie. And I have to take a moment and break it down where it's not offensive, not scary, but in a way that she can understand, but understanding that there's hope and optimism for a brighter day.
Well, you know what, though, April? In the book, you talk about how, as a mom, you owe it to your children. Moms owe it to their children to present a positive, optimistic front,
right,
even when all hell is breaking loose around them.
Exactly.
How do you do that, especially in the business that you're in, that we're in? There are some days when it's like life is a little too real.
Life is very real. And, you know, I look at it like this. And I'm going to give you an example. We had a goldfish and I know this sounds crazy, but we had a goldfish for like 5 years. And I was so proud of myself for keeping that goldfish alive for 5 years. And the goldfish kind of started dying one day. And I was like, oh, my goodness. And I mean, I was so upset. I ran and made sure I changed the water, changed the filter, and fed it. And it lived. And then one night, and I was up at 3 a.m., and I didn't look in the fishbowl. And the next morning, the fish was floating on the top. And I said, oh, my goodness. And I said, now the girls are going to be upset. I said, I am the person who sets the tone of this house. And I couldn't get on the table with emotion. And when I didn't get on the table, they were fine. They went to school. My baby daughter said, okay, let's have a ceremony. It almost reminded me of the scene in The Cosby Show, I believe the first Cosby Show. She stood at the toilet, and she said, do you have any words for Goldie? And I'm like, oh, my gosh, are we really doing this?
Art
and we
imitating
said goodbye
life.
And Goldie. Right. But the thing of it is that I set the tone by not being upset. Because I mourned that fish for a long time because I'm like, wait a minute. We kept that fish, and I'm not one to keep fish. And I said, and they loved the fish. And it was in my oldest daughter's room, and we, you know, we liked the fish. And I said, but see, when things happen, and like, for instance, remember Tamir Rice, the late Tamir Rice?
Yes, 12-year-old who was playing with a toy gun in a public park in Cleveland and shot dead by police.
My children are like any other children. My youngest daughter, both of them, they have the little archery, the soft tip archery sets, and the little cannon gun sets, soft tip cannon gun sets. And my baby daughter was out in our backyard, and we have a backyard that butts all of every backyard in our block. Mm-hmm. And she was out there with the cannon gun, the little soft tip cannon gun, and she was shooting. And my aunt said, "Come back in here." And she was like, "Why?" She didn't understand. She was puzzled. She said, a little kid was killed and because he had a gun, and you have to come in. And my child was all upset and didn't understand, and I had to tell her calmly. She said, Mommy, is that true? I said, yes, and I had to show her the video. And I said, look, I said, you can play inside, but this is real life. And I said, you can play with it inside the house, but unfortunately people don't understand sometimes now. And this poor little boy is gone, and we prayed for him. And I have to be the voice of reason, but also try to fix so let's do it this way so this may not happen.
Mm-hmm. And that was your Aunt Pearl who was the one who said, get in here, stop playing with that outside. But there was another situation that happened that I understand you talked to your daughters about, and that was what happened to Sandra Bland. And she was the African-American woman who was pulled over by a police officer for not signaling. And then within, 24 or 48 hours, she was found dead in her cell in Texas.
Again, my children watch television, and I have to tell them, this is real for us. You know, and they said, but what about, I said, they were asking me about the office. I said, look, I said, you have to comply and then complain. I said, you cannot, I said, right now the situation is such that we have to understand who we are, and we have to be respectful at all times and keep your, don't, you know, I talked about, you know, keeping your hands in certain places. You can't get out of a car. You can't do certain things. And it brings, this real life issue brings reality to mm-hmm. each and every home. And this book was actually born out of the unrest in Baltimore, the riots in Baltimore.
Right, and over Freddie Gray.
Over Freddie Gray. And that really hit home. And my baby, Gracie, was very concerned. She was scared because their school is 11.5 miles away from the flashpoint of Mondawmin Mall. I'm at the White House that day, and I'm getting all these calls. Are you seeing what's going on TV? Are you going to get the children? And I had to pack up, leave immediately. The closer to home I got, the farther it was. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to get home, and another parent, another female parent, picked up my children. And then they were shutting the school down, and they shut all the other little, the shops, the restaurants, doctor's offices, everything around that area was shutting down for fear that they were going to come out to our area. And in the meantime, we run to a local grocery store to get some food because we didn't know how long we were going to stay in the house. And we got some food, and while we were getting in the car to leave to go home, we saw this red pickup truck brandishing a Confederate flag going fast around the maze of the parking lot. And I looked at another African-American woman and said, is that a Confederate flag? And she said, yes. And everybody was like, oh, my gosh. And it was throwing gasoline on the fire. And my children were like, Mommy, what's going on? They didn't understand it. Yet again, we had you cannot not tell your children what's right. going on. They need to be aware so they can actively, successfully maneuver to keep their lives and to understand what's going on, because this is real life. This is not the cartoons anymore. This
right.
is real life
right.
that children see.
Now, a moment ago, you were talking about how, as a parent, you set the tone, mm-hmm. and the positive tone or the calm tone, the stable
yeah.
tone. But you write in the book, in this situation with the Confederate flag,
yeah.
your reporter instincts clicked
in.
And you were chasing after yeah. you were chasing after that car, that pickup truck, trying to take pictures, well, taking pictures of it, but trying to get pictures of the license plate. How did your daughters react to that?
My oldest daughter started crying. She was like, well, Mommy, what is this flag about? And I told her, hey, she said, no, Mommy, but the people that were driving the pickup truck realized what I was doing, and they got away. I called the police, and they had the right to express themselves. They had a constitutional right, but at that time, it was mm-hmm. throwing gasoline on the fire.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jonathan. Go ahead. Finish your thought. Sorry, April.
They were throwing gasoline on the fire. And my daughter, when I told her all of what was going on as we were driving to our home and this was happening, she started crying. She said, let's just go home. And it was overwhelming, but she understood mm-hmm. that this is not the right thing to do. And I wanted to make sure that all parties involved in that area were going to be safe. So that's mm-hmm. why at Reporter Instinct, took a picture of it, the visual, mm-hmm. had the picture of the license plate as much as I could, and called the police, mm-hmm. because if something would have happened, at least they would have something.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and this is the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm speaking with April Ryan, Washington Bureau Chief and White House correspondent for the American Urban Radio Network, and the author of At Mama's Knee, Mothers and Race in Black and White. Now, April, in this book, you talk to lots of people to get anecdotes from them. So I want to run through some of them. One, obviously, you mentioned her before, Valerie Jarrett. She's the senior advisor to President Obama. What perspective did she bring to your reporting and your understanding of the subject you're writing about?
Well, she is a mother, and she was a single mother, divorced mother. Over 30 years ago, she was married, and her husband decided to take another job in another community, and it shattered the family. And she raised her children, she mm-hmm. raised her daughter by herself. But her parents stepped in. Her father would take pick her daughter up from school, and her parents were there for her while she was a single parent raising her daughter. She talked about that, and she was very open and honest, and that's one of the reasons why she's really a supporter of women and girls. And I found a kindred spirit in that, being a single mother as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the piece that I pick up mm-hmm. from it. And she talked about her experiences growing up, you know, in a two-parent household with majorly successful parents.
Yeah.
And then here she goes. I mean, she was living the fairy tale. I mean, this was all a scripted-out fairy tale, it looked like. You know, she married the family friend. The families all knew each other, dating back to the grandparents. And she married this guy, and it should have been sugar and spice and everything nice, peaches and cream, and it wound up turning into a disaster. Mm-hmm. But she says, you know, sometimes it's better for a child to have one good parent than two.
Mm-hmm. You also write about Hillary Clinton's mother, Dorothy Rodham. What happened in Dorothy Rodham's life that was so important to you?
You know, Dorothy Rodham, listening to that story, it really, and I didn't put it in the book, but it really touched my heart, because I found out in talking to some of my family some things that Dorothy Rodham had in common with my grandmother. Mm. And that's a whole nother story by itself. And I found out some things, you know, in researching this book. But the thing that touched me about Dorothy Rodham is that she was a throwaway. This woman came from a dysfunctional family, and she really had to create her own life for herself. And in the midst of all of this, she became friends with some kids, some Japanese kids, who at that time they were dealing with issues of World War II and the issue of Japanese internment camps and all these things. But she became friendly with some Japanese kids. She was brought into an era of inclusion because she was this throwaway kid from a dysfunctional family.
Right. Her
family
parents
didn't care about it.
Yeah,
right.
Her parents abandoned her.
Her parents abandoned her. And then what she would do is she found a woman who took her in, allowed her to work, but she could go to school during the day, but she had to do her work, you know. And that was interesting. And then she was not bitter. She still believed in inclusion. She, when she was older and had Hillary Clinton in her family, Hillary Clinton talked about her church group, her youth church group. They were going to, there was an effort to go hear Dr. King when she was a young kid. Some of the parents were like, no. And Dorothy Rodham said, look, yes, you know, he's a great man. You must go hear him speak. And there was more of a shock that, you know, many of the families from a church group didn't want people to go hear Dr. King. And they also talked about how, she also talked about how her father extended an extra helping hand to those who worked for him in his small business, particularly African Americans, mm-hmm. understanding that there was a difference, a socioeconomic difference. And it was just, it really showed me more of the human side of her. From when she came, and
right.
it was very interesting and touching to hear that.
Well, let's talk about someone who is interesting and touching and very close to you, and that's your late mother, Vivian. Vivian Ryan. What did she teach you about race in America?
Ooh. Jonathan, we could go to a stoplight. She could be driving me to school, and we'd sit at a stoplight. She said, you know, a black man created that light. I'm like, really? And she'd say the name. And I remember as a kid, I think I had to do a project. I think it was like in third grade. I never stopped hearing about George Washington Carver and
mm-hmm.
the peanut. I was like, oh, my gosh. How many uses of a peanut? But, you know, those things, she always taught me, be proud of who you are. And, you know, you can be whoever you want to be or what you want to be as long as you work hard and study, and you're educated. And she really instilled a sense of loving myself and loving my community and looking into who we really are and not believing what people would say we were. And that's one thing she would always say, it's not what they call you, it's what you answer to.
Mm-hmm. And,
so,
how,
you know.
And so we're 16 days, I think you said, from having a new president of the United States, or a president of the United States who ran a campaign that was not your traditional campaign. And as I have written many times, was one that was racist, xenophobic, and misogynistic, among a whole lot of other things. Given what you just said about your mother's advice to you about loving yourself and being true to yourself and knowing who you are, how challenging do you think it's going to be in the age of Trump for people to stand up for who they are and what they believe in the face of what could be major pushback from their own government?
Well, I say this. President-elect Donald Trump, when he was running for office, he told us what he was going to do, and he's showing us who he will be. And when someone shows you and tells you, believe them. I mean, look at the cabinet. It's not diverse. George W. Bush had the most diverse cabinet for Republican, well, had the most diverse presidency for Republican than any other Republican president. This president is making no bones about it. He says, I'm not politically correct. There are also concerns about, you know, the Justice Department under Sessions. There's so many concerns. There are concerns about Obamacare. But what you have to do is you have to remember the squeaky wheel gets the oil. And this country was built upon people, built by people, built for people. And in my research lately, in reporting, I talked to Chris Darden, and he's in the book as well, former O.J. Simpson prosecutor, dear friend. And he is a black Republican who was just angry that night of the election. And he said, it's now time for new activism. And then you hear another African-American successful businessman, billionaire Bob Johnson, who says this is a time for us to find common ground. I asked Kwaisi Mfume, the former head of the NAACP,
former congressman,
what do you think about both of this? He said both men are right, but we are at a crossroads. And I think Chris Darden is right, and so is Bob Johnson, and so is Kwaisi Mfume. I think it's a time of activism as well as a time of finding common ground. And again, and this is what I say, and I've always said since I've been here in Washington, 20 years and a couple of days, wow. I'm still young. I say the squeaky wheel gets the oil. And the most successful movement in this nation that other groups have latched onto the blueprint, is the civil rights movement. So we just have to wait and see what comes down the road.
And in one sentence or less, or phrase, how likely do you think it is that people of color and those who are concerned about the incoming Trump administration will be squeaky wheels? Is the energy out there?
Oh, the energy is out there. The head of the NAACP, the national head, Cornell Brooks, went to jail in Alabama for protesting today. We've got marches planned in the next couple of days by Al Sharpton, women's rights groups, the Million Women's March.
The day after the inauguration.
Oh, there's going to be protest. And I understand that President-elect Donald Trump reached out to Reverend Al Sharpton, too, you know, saying, oh, I hear you're going to do this and do that. So he knows. But you know, if you squeak long enough and loud enough, persistently enough, with enough people, you will get the attention. And now the question is, after you get the attention, how do you leverage for what you want?
And that is a great question to end on. April Ryan, thank you very much for being on.
Thank you, Jonathan.
I've been speaking with the journalist April Ryan about addressing racial bias in America from a parent's perspective. Her latest book is At Mama's Knee, Mothers and Race in Black and White.
Ilya Marritz in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC, and here's a weird factoid. In the 19th century, astronomers' assistants were known as computers. Yes, computers. And at a time when there were few opportunities for women scientists, the Harvard College Observatory hired quite a few female computers for this job. Although their work led to groundbreaking discoveries, these women have largely been forgotten until now. Science writer Dava Sobel writes about their remarkable contributions to astronomy in a new book called The Glass Universe: How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. It's published by Viking, and I am pleased to welcome Dava Sobel to our show today. Hello.
Hi there.
What is this glass universe in the title of your book?
It refers to a collection of 500,000 photographs on glass plates of the night sky that were taken over a period of 100 years. This was the vision of the director of the observatory to create a unique resource that could be used for answering all the questions people had about the stars. At the beginning of this story, nobody knew what the stars were made of or why they generated heat and light, how far away they were. And by the end of it, that was all pretty much unraveled.
Right, and these glass plates, there's a few pictures in your book, they don't necessarily look like the night sky if you or I were going to our backyard and just look up. No.
Yeah, most of them are negatives. So even the ones that just show starscapes are black on white, and that's unusual. Also, they're taken through the telescope, so there's a lot of detail that you wouldn't see just looking up. And many of them are taken through prisms so that the starlight is spread out into the spectrum. And those images were used to understand the composition of the stars.
And so these glass plates, that was the job of the women that you profile in your book, to basically decode them and make sense of what came in on the plates. Is that right?
That's right. And the term computer was a little older before the introduction of photography, because there was always math to do with the observatory, any observatory. There were computers wherever there were observatories. And most often they were men, but sometimes they were women. And at Harvard early on, they were the family members of the resident astronomers. So that was how women really got their first entree. And then they did so well in the work that the director thought it would be great to just hire women from outside because, of course, they were less expensive. And that's the subtle play of the title, that it's a glass universe, but there was something of a glass ceiling, too.
Right. So you write quite a bit about the Harvard Observatory director, Edward Pickering, this man who was willing to sort of
thoroughly good guy,
go beyond having, you know, wives and daughters help out from time to time, but actually hire women. What was he like? What have you been able to learn about his sort of state of mind as he was actually like writing employment contracts?
He was the most forward-thinking, polite person I have ever encountered. And he, although he might be accused of paying them lower wages than men, that was just a reality he couldn't get past. But he was so supportive of the women. He always gave them credit in all the published work for everything they did. He nominated them for prizes. And he was such a supporter of higher education for women. At a time when people thought college was bad for girls, that college could actually negatively affect a woman's ability to bear children, if you can believe that. And he felt the way to disprove that idea was to give a lot of women a chance to do real work in science and show what they could contribute. And so in addition to the women he hired, he put out a call to college graduates who had telescopes to make observations from home and send them to Harvard, and they would be collated and published, and that then these women could help prove the value of their education.
And we're talking sort of mid to late 19th century.
We're talking 1880s, 1890s.
When
there were a lot of women's colleges opening.
I was going to say, were there a lot of women who had the kind of math education to do this work, and what was their other choice if they happened to have a knack for math and didn't end up at the observatory?
There weren't a lot of other choices, and there weren't a lot of opportunities either. That's why the volunteer aspect was also important.
So let's talk about some of the women who got involved in this. I don't know where you want to begin, but I thought Henrietta Swan Leavitt was pretty interesting.
She's pretty interesting, yeah. Her discovery really, I'm not exaggerating, but it laid the basis for all of modern cosmology, because her discovery provided a way to measure distance across space. When you look up at the sky, you have no idea what's close and what's far. Some things look brighter than others, but maybe they're extremely bright and far away, and the dim things are actually just naturally dim and close. So her discovery helped create a yardstick, which is still in use today. And so,
and yet her name is pretty much, I mean, is it known at least in the astronomical community?
Absolutely. Every astronomer knows her name.
Uh-huh.
And there is a movement afoot now, I'm happy to tell you, to change the name of her discovery, which has an unwieldy title. It's called the period-luminosity relation. But people are starting to call it the Leavitt law.
Henrietta Swan Leavitt,
and then her name will revive.
And a few of the discoveries that these women made have endured to this day. You write about Annie Jump Cannon. I hope I'm saying that right.
Yes, one of the great names.
I don't know how you get Jump as a middle name, but why not? And she created sort of a stellar classification system.
Yes, that was one of the goals at the beginning, to look at the spectra of the stars, those strips of separated starlight that had passed through a prism, and try to create a taxonomy, some way to get hold of what the stars were. Were there different types? Were they made of different chemicals, or were they at different life stages in their evolution? All of this was unknown. So the trick was to look at these patterns and try to group the stars according to common patterns. And that is not easy to see. So you're looking at a glass plate that could have thousands of tiny little strips of starlight. So you're looking with a magnifying glass, and then you're comparing one to another and assigning a classification category. And she did this for nearly 500,000 stars.
While being deaf, I should add.
She was deaf, but she wore a hearing aid and was a great opera fan.
Okay, well, why not? Why not?
I know that because she saved all the programs from all the operas she attended, and they're all still in the Harvard archives.
Reading your book, you really come away with the impression that, one, the sciences were not well-funded at the time. They were constantly having to raise money.
They were privately funded, yes. And what interested me in this story was how much of the money came from women.
As benefactors as well.
Yes, yes.
And then the other sort of abiding impression is it seems like the women started to get involved right at a time when studying the stars went from sort of a hobby activity to something that was much more academic and professionalized.
Well, the professional astronomers were stuck doing the really boring work of establishing stellar positions. The astronomers who were skilled and wealthy enough, the amateur astronomers, could pursue whatever aspect they liked. And so this whole question of using the spectra really got a push from the amateurs. So Anna Draper, who was the main funder of the project, she and her husband were at the forefront of that work. And just when they were going to devote their lives to it, he fell ill and died. He was only 45. And she very much wanted to continue the work, live out his dream, and she couldn't do it alone. So she gave the money to Pickering at Harvard and said, if you do the work, I'll pay for it. She gave him more than what he had as an annual operating budget. And she kept that up for 3 decades.
It seems like this must have been a tremendous opportunity for any woman with a really active brain and a knack for math. What did you learn about the women's own professional satisfaction from their letters and the documents that you found, given that what they were doing really was so unusual?
Oh, they knew it. They loved their work. They were there 6 days a week, long hours. They socialized together on Saturday night. It was definitely
What did Saturday night look like for them? Stargazing?
Oh, Mrs. Fleming. Sometimes there was stargazing of a professional sort. If they were working on a project that required them to be at the observatory, they might go back on a Saturday night. Mrs. Fleming, who was the first woman to hold a title at Harvard, she was the curator of astronomical photographs, she was generally the hostess at her place and would provide food, and they would sing, someone would play the piano, there were games. Jack Straws was a popular game.
That's one I haven't tried.
It's like pickup sticks.
All right. So how did this go down as these women, worked in the world? Were there? Did they have angry husbands and fathers?
Oh, they didn't have husbands. No. Working working meant you were not married. So at the very beginning, if a woman got married, she left. Later, by the 1930s, it was more permissible to be a married woman and work. But these women were married to the job, and they stayed there 40, 50 years.
Ilya Meritz on WNYC, in for Leonard Lope. The book is The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And the author is Dava Sobel, also the best-selling author of the book Longitude. When it comes to like unearthing the role of women in science, it seems like there's sort of a renewed effort to do that and to try to shed some light on some forgotten chapters. I'm thinking of this movie that's in theaters now about the African-American women who kind of helped
Hidden Figures
helped put John Glenn in space. But
see, they were really computers.
In terms of the work that they were doing.
Yes.
How hard is it to find a story like this? Are these stories documented?
This story is extremely well documented, as is Hidden Figures. I first came on the Harvard Women more than 20 years ago because an astronomer I was interviewing, Wendy Friedman, who was working on a Hubble telescope key project about the expansion rate of the universe, mentioned the name Henrietta Leavitt to me as a crucial figure in the history of this work, and I had never heard of her. And then when I looked into her story, I discovered she was working in a room full of women, which seemed remarkable to me. One doesn't think of Harvard as a hotbed of female opportunity, but there they were. And I was surprised that no one had written it up. There was a biography of Henrietta Leavitt by George Johnson some years ago. It's called Miss Leavitt's Stars. But I wanted to treat the group and the situation, because the situation led to a graduate program in education. When Harvard finally started a graduate level program in astronomy, all the first students were women.
No kidding.
Because of this history.
No kidding.
And because the donors had set up fellowships for women to come and work at the observatory for a year and then be able to go on to another observatory with that training. And because all of the fellowship money was specifically earmarked for women, the only fellowship money available for graduate students.
And that was the group they called Pickering's Harem. So
well,
I guess
Pickering's Harem was earlier. That was that was the computer group, the women looking. But they didn't. That term is a more recent term.
Oh,
and
I see.
Pickering would never have said that.
And did the effects of this group go beyond Harvard? In other words, is astronomy like a more gender-balanced field than some of the other sciences, I'm wondering?
I don't know that I could really speak to that, especially today. Things are changing so quickly. But certainly, the number of women who went through an apprenticeship at Harvard and then went to work somewhere else was significant. And also, because astronomy was always a global endeavor, everybody knew the Harvard women. Everybody knew how productive they were. And they had contacts with other astronomers around the world, correspondence that survives. So it was well known that women could be given these positions of responsibility and handle them admirably.
And so what kind of adversity? I mean, it sounds like a very smooth ride, but they must have encountered some adversity.
Well, mostly they complained about the low pay. But this is nothing new. And it persists, as we know. So, but the work was fascinating to them.
And to you, as a science writer and a woman, why does it matter to you so much to tell a story like this?
I think in this day and age, especially this particular moment in history, when there's a lot of fake news and there is a lot of anti-science bias, anybody who can tell a true story about science, and especially a true story about women in science, can take that opportunity and feel good about it.
Yeah. Did the women often have trouble getting respect from the other male scientists, maybe not at Harvard because it sounds like it was an amazing environment, but they were corresponding with Germany and South America, locations all around the world.
No, they really, I didn't see any evidence of that. It was the case of you do something significant and you do it well, you get the respect. They really gained a good place in everyone's estimation.
I understand the original glass plates that these women star scientists worked with.
They're all still at Harvard.
And they're being digitized.
They're being digitized now because they're still of great value.
Really?
Yes. It's important to be able to look back over a period of 100 years and take a new discovery and look at that area of the sky and see what was there 50, 60 years ago. Sometimes that's crucial. People have been coming to the observatory to study the plates. Pickering used to send them out to people to borrow. But once they're digitized, they'll be available to everyone. And of course, they're glass, so they're fragile. We'd rather not have people touching them.
Precious cargo.
Yes.
I've been speaking with Dava Sobel about her book, The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. Unlikely, forgotten chapter of history. Very cool stuff. It was named one of the best books of 2016 by NPR, The Economist, and Smithsonian, and it's published by Viking. Dava, thank you so much.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and today for Leonard Lopate, this is WNYC and WNYC.org. On New Year's Eve, a gunman entered a nightclub in Istanbul and opened fire, killing 39 people and wounding many others. This was the latest brutal attack that ISIS claimed credit for. But nobody seems to know yet if the gunman was trained by ISIS or radicalized by ISIS propaganda online. This confusion echoes a larger confusion about ISIS itself and who truly belongs to ISIS. Graham Wood, a national correspondent for The Atlantic, investigated this nebulous world by really trying to understand the people who devote their lives to the Islamic State and what that means for the future of the Middle East. His latest book from Random House is The Way of Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State. And I'm very pleased that it brings Graham Wood here to the studio to join me. Thank you very much for coming on.
Good to be here.
So, wasn't there some controversy in calling this group the Islamic State instead of ISIS or ISIL or is it Daesh?
Yeah, in Arabic they call it Daesh.
Daesh.
I think it's something of a red herring to be too excited about the different names. I actually had one person who's a supporter of the Islamic State tell me, "We love it when you, the West, are debating whether to call us ISIS or the Islamic State because it means you're not taking us seriously. You're just talking about names." In the end, Daesh is just the Arabic abbreviation for the Islamic State, mm-hmm. and ISIS, the first two letters, are Islamic State. So mm-hmm. one way or another, they get the words they want into their name.
Well, I was fascinated by what you said, that the supporter of ISIS said, like, we love it that you're arguing over names means you're not taking us seriously. And if you pay attention to any of the media, you would think that because we're talking about them so much that we are taking them seriously, no?
Yeah, for them, though, what does it mean to take them seriously from their perspective? It means to talk about how to fight them. It means what military action is going to be taken against them. And it means what ideological action is going to be taken against them. That is, what are the debates within theology, within Islam, that would really undercut their position? They've taken a very, very extreme position on the Islamic spectrum. And I think what they worry about most is, first of all, simply being annihilated militarily, but also the intellectual currents within Islam that they're reacting against. The battle of ideas is not over, and they want to make sure that we're focusing on names rather than the ideas themselves.
And so when did you first hear about ISIS?
The first time I ever heard ISIS by name was, I suppose, in 2013 when they first adopted that name. And they were really just an outgrowth of Al-Qaeda at that point, but we started to hear rumblings of excitement from around the world among jihadists that they might be something more. And then the really important actual metamorphosis was when they became the Islamic State in mid-2014, and then there was just an eruption of excitement among just jihadists saying, this is something new, this is something world historical.
Is that when they took over Mosul?
Yes, soon after they took over Mosul.
Soon after. And the other thing that made, that put ISIS on the map, if you will, for the Western audience, particularly the Americans, is that they made Al-Qaeda look like the Cub Scouts.
Yeah,
in terms
exactly.
of their brutality. Was that by design?
Absolutely. Yeah, they took the things that Al-Qaeda had shied away from in its own self-presentation as an Islamic movement. So in the early history of Islam, as in other religions, there was slavery, there were brutal capital punishments, and Al-Qaeda had certainly used violence, but it hadn't made the reinstitution of slavery one of its hallmarks. And ISIS, the Islamic State, right off the bat, they said, we're going to revive all of the institutions that you, the modern world, find most repulsive. We want to repel you because it purifies our ranks and makes sure that only the people who are most committed to us are on our side.
So slavery, war, murder, as a way, doing all of those things as a way of becoming more pure.
Yes, it's an act of purification. They say, our prophet practiced slavery, practiced sex slavery, and these are things that everyone in the entire planet really has been taught are bad things. So if we can convince you to come to us and we're really telling the whole world that we're reviving these institutions, then you must be really on our side. You must really believe. And, you know, against all the voices that you're hearing in your home countries, that means the United States, that means the UK, if you decide that sex slavery is an okay thing, then you might be on the right track and you might be someone who would be at home with us.
And these are all the things that differentiated ISIS from jihadists in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere.
Yeah, I think if you looked at the things that Al-Qaeda wanted, they would talk about Israel, they would talk about tyrants in the Middle East. They would not talk quite so much about the apocalypse, about the end of time, and about reinstituting ancient institutions like slavery, like the caliphate, and that is what ISIS was all about.
So So given what you said earlier about slavery, murder, mayhem being so extreme as a way of purifying oneself, which makes me think, okay, who are these people? Who are the people who gravitate to this? And it's not just, we're not just talking about people in the Middle East, in Iraq, in Syria. We're talking about people all over the world who are drawn to what ISIS is doing and what ISIS believes. Is there sort of a general sketch of who that person is?
So for my book, I went to find as many of these people as possible. And whenever I could, I was sitting directly across from them and just asking them, who are you? Where did you come from? And why do you believe these things? And often I would find that they are people who are very familiar to me. That is, they were coming from the same types of societies that I was raised in. They spoke my language. They were really completely normal people, except they happened to be completely morally insane as a result of their belief in ISIS.
You just said that these were people, I think you said, like you, just maybe sitting in a coffee shop, folks you would just see around, wherever they're not.
We would have the same cultural references. We'd watch the same movies. We'd understand the same jokes. We would have even the same, in some cases, the same instincts of revulsion at some of the things that ISIS was doing. But unlike me, they would take that instinctive revulsion and suppress it. They would have an intellectualized way of seeing something like sex slavery as a good thing, whereas I was sitting there dumbfounded in front of my teacup and wondering how a person from suburban Melbourne, or in one case from Dallas, Texas, was actually willing to believe that these horrible things are blessings and signs of God's favor.
So I think the popular vision of a supporter of ISIS is again, someone who is sitting in the Middle East, someone who doesn't share our, meaning Western American, values, and certainly not someone who shares our cultural references. And it sounds to me like we in the West, and particularly in the United States, are making a big mistake in thinking that we are separate and apart from these folks who are gravitating towards ISIS.
Yeah, I think that's right. That you can almost think of ISIS in as a two-part organization. There is the Iraqi Syrian side of it, which is a political struggle, a war that's been going on for a while. And then there are the foreigners. There are the 40,000 odd foreign fighters who have come from the United States, from the UK, from Norway, from Japan. And these ones, they have a different set of motivations. They have seen ISIS not as the resolution of a local political conflagration, but as the fulfillment of a utopian dream. So I went to Tokyo and I spoke to someone who had gone to ISIS from there. He had since returned. And I asked him, what did you see? And he said, I saw a beautiful multicultural paradise. He described crossing the border in the company of Brits, Russians, Uyghurs, and everyone was suddenly made equal by their Islamic unity. He found it a beautiful thing. I found other people from the United States who had gone there, and they had simply taken up with a very, very fringe belief within Islam in the revival of a caliphate. And they, too, they thought that it was a great thing. This was something that had been prophesied 1,400 years ago. And the very fact of its existence meant that it was going to be great and it was going to be victorious over the rest of the world.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, speaking with Graham Wood of The Atlantic about his new book, The Way of Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State, and it comes to us from Random House. So, Graham, let's talk about some specific people you talked to. There was an Australian doctor, Tarek Kamle.
I did not speak to Tarek Kamle, but he is from Adelaide, Australia. He was a bit of a playboy at one point. And the last
he joined early on.
He went there, pretty early on in ISIS's evolution. When he got there, the first thing we saw of him publicly was a public service announcement where he's standing in a hospital and he's describing the free socialized medicine that ISIS offers. So it was, again, a case of someone who... he viewed ISIS as the fulfillment of the kind of socialized medicine dream that he had been taught through his Hippocratic Oath and through his professional standards in Australia to expect there. He just said ISIS actually did it.
Okay, so this is incredible. You're talking about a doctor who has taken the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm, and yet he's joined an organization, an ideology that we talked about at the top of this conversation, that is sex slavery, murder, mayhem. How do these folks write off all these brutal aspects of ISIS? I mean, here's a doctor who's praising the fact that they offer socialized medicine, but is like willfully blinding himself to the really reprehensible aspects, morally reprehensible aspects of ISIS.
Yeah, talk about cognitive dissonance. I mean, he's in a state where they're publicly beheading people in the exact city where he's practicing his socialized medicine. But I think for him, I can only speculate that he sees this as a path to something greater. He says, look, we're at war. There are terrible things that will happen when we're at war. When we're victorious, then we'll just have the good parts and we won't have to have all of this killing. In the meantime, he claimed in one of his letters back home to the licensing board in Australia that said maybe his license should be suspended in Australia, he said, don't worry, first of all, I'm never coming back. But second of all, most of the violence I see is little kids who are blown apart by bombs from a coalition that includes Australia.
Let's talk about another Australian you profile, and that's Musa Chetantonio. What did you learn about him and why he supports ISIS?
Well, Musa Chetantonio is a convert, a Roman Catholic convert to Islam, and he had become a kind of unofficial translator for the movement. By the time I found him, he was one of the people online who had been gathering people up, sending them off to the Islamic State, and really telling the broader world what the message of the Islamic State was. Luckily for him, perhaps, and certainly for me, he had had his passport taken away from Australia, and so he was stranded in Melbourne. And that meant I could go talk to him and play soccer with his jihadist soccer team and hang out with him in cafes, have pizza. We had a good time for several days, and I had nothing but the hard sell about the Islamic State and a vivid description of why it was the greatest thing ever.
I want to talk about this hard sell when we come back from this break. I'm speaking with Graham Wood, a national correspondent for The Atlantic, about understanding the Islamic State's true believers. His latest book is The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State. I'm Jonathan Capehart. In today for Leonard Lopate, this is WNYC and WNYC.org. We'll be back with more after the break. Jonathan Capehart in for Leonard Lopate today. I'm speaking with Graham Wood. Just a fascinating discussion we're having about his new book, The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State. I'm just sort of dumbfounded by the conversation we're having about the people who are willfully sort of suppressing the horror that the Islamic State does in order to be a part of this. And before we went to break, you were talking about how Musa Chetantonio, who is a convert to Islam in Australia, who you spent a lot of time with for this book, and you said he constantly the hard sell on convincing you that what they were doing was right, or convincing you to join the Islamic State.
I think the ideal outcome would be, yes, my joining the Islamic State.
But, and so what was that hard sell like?
There's a lot of talk in Islamic State recruiting about the punishments for those who don't join. These are punishments in the afterlife, as well as the threats that you know in this world that they'll offer to you. He never said to me, "I'm going to kill you." In fact, he was a very nice guy in my interactions with him. But they always say, "Look, there is a series of punishment that awaits any person, including Muslims, in the afterlife. And if you join the Islamic State, especially if you're martyred, then you bypass that. There is no purgatory. You are favored by God. And if you don't, then he would describe in vivid detail the punishments that would await anyone else, including Muslims who didn't accept the Islamic State, that they would be considered in many cases apostates and not Muslims at all. So there's a really strong negative downside to not joining the Islamic State, according to him.
He is a prominent person within the Islamic State.
Within the propaganda apparatus of the Islamic State and outside of the Islamic State especially, trying to get foreigners to go there, he was very prominent until he was kind of silenced. Now, the person who is even more prominent, who he alluded to, and eventually I was able, through some detective work, investigative work, to identify, was his teacher, who turned out to be an American and is the top propagandist in the English language for the Islamic State now. He's over there, and he's from Dallas, Texas.
Yeah, let's talk about him. His name is John Georgeless.
Yes, that's right. About 33 years old now, and born in Texas, raised in Colorado, Virginia, and Texas. And as of 2015, he was in Raqqa, producing a magazine, a slick magazine called Dabiq, which is kind of like the in-flight magazine of the Islamic State.
I mean, when I think slick magazine, I'm thinking like an actual magazine, glossy pages, sort of like a Departures magazine that you get from American Express.
You're not far off. I mean, this
is
magazine,
it actually a physical magazine, or is it on it's online?
They'll send it out in PDF format, but okay. The design is something that would be familiar to it. It's like a well-produced new men's magazine. It looks like it might be Maxim, but instead of scantily clad women, there are no women, and instead there are images of people being beheaded, having their hands cut off, and American soldiers with photoshopped flames around them.
So you have a slick magazine that is being produced by the top propagandists that you just talked about, and yet despite having pictures of people being beheaded and arms and hands being chopped off, people are still able to suppress and deny those images and think about the good stuff?
And that's, I think, some of the evil brilliance of the Islamic State. the whole purpose of this magazine is to take people who have some passing acquaintance with their religion, Islam, and then to convince them that the only way they can practice it is by instituting the most repulsive punishments in the legal tradition of Islam and instituting a new political system called the caliphate. So you read this and you go from, oh, I've heard about a caliphate as a Muslim, but I've never seen some of these verses that exhort me to actually institute it right now or support it if it exists. So that's what John Georgelis is producing in an American voice. I mean, it's what was most extraordinary to me was to discover that the reason that some of these words are so persuasive to people is that they're coming from people who are from Australia or from the United States and who speak the language of persuasion.
Right, the cultural references you were talking about before, they speaking the same language.
Yeah, this is a skateboarding kid who, you know, it's a very familiar type from any American high school in the last 20 years. Some loser kid who is into drugs and skateboarding and computer hacking, and who at some point took a very severe wrong turn toward radical Islam. And now he's doing that. He's gone pro in the Islamic State.
Okay, so this brings me back to a question I should have asked you earlier on, because when we were talking about just getting a general overview of ISIS, you talked about how the Islam that the Islamic State practices or focuses on is on the extreme of the Islamic spectrum, I think is what you said. So it makes me wonder, do you think, is it appropriate or right, would you call them a legitimate branch of Islam?
Well, for me, as a non-Muslim, I don't think that any branch is legitimate or illegitimate. They claim to be part of Islam. And others, their enemies, also claim to be part of Islam, and they have equal claim to that patrimony. The thing about the Islamic State that I think a lot of people don't realize, and that is, I think, embarrassing, actually, for a lot of other Muslims, is that when they cite scripture, when they cite historical precedent, they are citing actual scripture, they're citing actual history. The thing is that they just take an interpretation of it that is brutal, intolerant, and an extreme minority within the religion of Islam.
What do you say to, I mean, there are many Muslim scholars and activists who oppose ISIS, and they say that they know, meaning ISIS, knows nothing about Islam. What's your take on that?
Well, these are matters of religion. You know, it is certainly true that the vast majority of Muslim scholars say ISIS is wrong, that it's on the right track, on the wrong track, and that it's extremely sinful. But because it's religion, it's not as if there is a right or wrong answer to these things. It's not like chemistry. So ISIS has its own arguments in its favor, and most Muslims reject them, which is fine and great. The thing is that, again, it's not as if you can finally give proof that one side is right, one side is wrong.
Wait a minute. You just said ISIS has arguments in its favor.
Yeah, ISIS has its own scholars. They have this little factory that produces fatwas. And the people who are in that factory, they're definitely crankish. They are fringe characters. But, you know, crankish and fringe characters exist within the American legal tradition, within other religions. You know, if you find someone who's an extreme Protestant, then that person is generally considered still to be a Protestant. The extremeness is just a different form of the religion. And it's the same case with ISIS.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and speaking with, having a fascinating conversation with Graham Wood about his new book, The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State from Random House. John Georgelis, Musa Cherantonio, Tarek Kamle, these, just by your description of them, run counter to the American perception of who a member of ISIS is. And particularly, if you go online and you type in Musa Cherantonio, he's Australian, he has a beard, but I mean, he's a good looking guy. We're not talking about, or I should say, the popular perception is that members of ISIS are folks from the Middle East region. They are poor, and that's one of the reasons why they link up with something like ISIS, because they're at the and they're hopeless, they have no dreams, so on and so forth. And just through this entire conversation and reading about these folks and seeing who they are and listening to this conversation, we are making a huge mistake if we think that the only problem in fighting ISIS is that we just need to make the Middle East a democratic republic.
That's definitely one of the misconceptions about ISIS support. John Georgulis, whose identity was never revealed until my book, he comes from a family in Dallas where the dad is a radiologist. His granddad was a major real estate mogul in Northern Virginia. And it's a family with a long and storied military tradition in the U.S. Army. It's not as if he was from a position of privation. What instead he had was a kind of deficit of, I guess, meaning in his life. There was a kind of rebellion that he was able to find meaning in. And for him, it was Islam. It was turning away from that family's tradition and instead creating a tradition of his own. He ended up, of course, himself being a soldier in the Islamic State and a major intellectual figure in the Islamic State. It's not that he didn't have a job, that he didn't have a future. It was that he didn't have the excitement, the meaning, and to have a religious movement come to you and say, this is the apocalypse. There is no greater meaning that you could ever experience than coming to us. It couldn't be resisted.
We haven't even talked about, or I should say I haven't even asked about the apocalyptic vision that is, I guess, appealing to folks who joined the Islamic State. And maybe this is well my own sort of personal prejudice here, which is I can't get into apocalyptic visions. I mean,
good for you.
I mean, life is hard, but it's worth living. And if your entire life is filled with any day now, end of the world is coming, and I'm gonna be a part of it by joining a death cult? I don't know.
From your perspective, from my perspective, this seems like throwing your life away. From their perspective, it's exactly the opposite. They just say that this terrestrial life that we are supposedly throwing away is figmentary. It's not a real thing. Instead, there is a greater battle that our lives on Earth, even if they're cut short tomorrow, that we would be better contributing to that greater battle than to contribute to our comforts here.
I'm the idea of John, I keep wanting to say George Johnless, John Georgulis in his storied family. I can understand converting to Islam, converting to another religion, but the idea of converting to another religion and then occupying the extreme end of it. And I know there are a lot of people out there who do not consider the Islamic State and what they practice to be Islam. And I'm going on the parameters that you set, Graham. I'm still having a hard time seeing how someone like him, someone like Musa Chet Antonio, can go from these lives not of privation to
and then go all the way over to the Islamic
all
State.
All the way over.
When I talk to people who had been his students, I would ask, tell me about your teacher. Tell me about how John Georgulis from Plano, Texas, progressed. And one of them said, look, this was a kid who didn't do so well in school, but he was smart. And as soon as he went to the Middle East, he taught himself Arabic to a degree that was actually beyond the capacity of most educated Arabs. So it was as if he was finding a calling in a sphere that his home life, his upbringing, hadn't even recognized. The idea that you would go to a different religion and then excel in it after finding that your Greek Orthodox background or your Texan background, you had a kind of glass ceiling on your life there. He found he could really excel at jihadism. And over the course of over a decade, he has risen to the very top. I mean, there is not a large number of people who are at the echelons of the Islamic State's propaganda apparatus that he's at. He's a rising star, and he's still over there.
Does he fear for his life?
I don't know. You know, once you get to the Islamic State, the messages that you send out are tightly controlled. This is by design. They want to make sure that there is an official message that nothing deviates from that. And he happens to be one of the people who's kind of behind the microphone, literally, for the Islamic State radio. So we hear what his official voice is, but we don't know what his inner insecurities are. You can only assume that he is going to be one of the people who's targeted with drone strikes and what have you. So if he fears for life at all, then he would be fearing right now.
Have you ever feared for your life when reporting, not just for this book, for you've written multiple stories about this. Have you ever feared for your life doing any of this?
You know, it's odd. I've reported for years in the Middle East, and there have been several times when I thought it was possible I was going to die. I was in Mosul as one of the very last reporters in central Mosul before the Islamic State took it over. I was afraid then. In reporting this, though, I've been talking to people in the most comfortable positions. It's been in coffee shops. It's been in pizzerias. It's been in Tokyo. And I've asked them now and then, look, from everything you've told me, you think it's okay to slit my throat right now before I finish my tea. Shouldn't I be afraid of you? And the usual answer was one that I actually took at face value, which is, you have come to us openly, Mr. Reporter. You want us to tell you about our religion, about what we believe. If you ask us in a spirit of openness and honesty about these questions, we have no, there's nothing we can do except to answer you. We need to answer your questions. It's an obligation spiritually for us to do so. And it would be okay if sometime down the road, if you don't accept it, for us to kill you. But in the meantime, you are our guest.
So at such time to come and kill you, but like hunt you down? Because you could write something that they don't like, and they might decide that it's...
Don't give them any ideas.
I'm not trying to give them any ideas. I'm trying to understand.
I had, you know, Musa Charantonio told me after the first time I wrote about him that he had corresponded with some of his friends in Syria, and they had read my writings, and they said, if you talk to that journalist again, give him a hug for us, because he's an infidel, but he's a good infidel. He accurately reported what you were saying, and that's the most we could ever hope from him.
Wow. I mean, so folks in the Islamic State are just like everybody else. They want to be understood, and I guess, as you said, you went to them openly, really wanting to understand. Given what you said, does that mean, through your reporting, do you think that there's a way for the United States, for the West, to engage with members of the Islamic State in the way you did, through more official channels?
I think it would be very difficult. The things that they believe, and these are unalterable beliefs in most cases, are completely incompatible with our notions of human rights, with the dignity of humans as humans. These are things that they won't give up. So a lot of them are, I'm afraid to say, lost causes. That doesn't mean, though, that there isn't a form of discussion that can't be helpful in the broader world about some of these topics. As I say, this is a religious interpretation. There are disputes within Islam about individual topics that the Islamic State holds dear, and those absolutely need to continue. What I think we're really bound by, though, as Americans, is that the majority of us are not Muslims. Our government certainly is not an Islamic government. And so many of those discussions have to take place between Muslims, and we need to sit back and, unfortunately, watch them happen, perhaps over the course of some bloody years.
This has been just an incredible conversation. In your book, you try to make people understand an entity, the Islamic State, that I think most Americans only know superficially, and only, I think, probably by design, just because the images that come back at us about what the Islamic State is up to and what they're doing and how they're trying to expand their reach is just so jarring and horrifying. But I congratulate you, Graham, on this book. I've been speaking with Graham Wood, a national correspondent for The Atlantic, about understanding the Islamic State's true believers. His latest book is The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.